Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What sort of power is contained in the vast quantities of information collected and analyzed by today's very powerful computers? And what are the consequences when the results seem to demonstrate connections we can't explain? The era of big data allows us to use technology to spot patterns and correlations in a sea of seemingly unrelated information, which can be used to keep us healthy and lead us instantly to the products and content we really want. But when big data is used to predict human behavior on an individual basis, to decide who is creditworthy, who's employable, even who is likely to break the law, there is a risk that innocent people will pay the price for what they haven't done yet and may never have done in the future. Victor Meyer Schoenberger joins us to talk about that. He is professor of Internet Governance and Regulation at the Oxford Internet University Institute at Oxford University. His new book, written with Kenneth Cukier, is called Big Data, a Revolution That Will Transform How We Live, Work, and Think. Victor, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much, Chris, for having me.
Start us off, if you would, with a good working definition of what the phrase big data means.
Big data means that we have now much more data available about a problem that we want to investigate than ever before, and that lets us gain insights into better understanding of that problem than ever before.
So things that were not visible on a sort of human scale in the analog world suddenly become very clear when you have a computer.
Yes, they do. It is almost like having a lens or a microscope to peer into the data.
And this feels like a brand new phenomenon, but you remind us that we've been sort of working up to the state of things today for a long time.
Oh, yes, indeed. We have had hundreds and hundreds of years of trying to quantify the world by measuring distance and time and weight and so many other things up into the 19th and into the 20th century. So the quantifying our world movement has been on for centuries. The problem was then that in the analog age, tabulating all that data up takes an enormous amount of time and costs a lot of money. So, for example, the 1890 census in the United States took 6 years to tabulate.
But today, of course, it's not only easier to tabulate all this information and analyze it, but it's vastly cheaper to hang on to information, even though we don't know right now how we might use it.
Yes, indeed. Up until very recently, we collected data. The little that we did collect, we collected it for a singular purpose. And then we used it for that purpose, and then we threw it away because it was way too expensive to store it. The beauty of big data is that we can extract value once we have used it for the first purpose, and data keeps on giving. It's like gold that's hidden. It's a treasure that we can unearth, and it keeps on giving.
So give us some examples, Victor, of how big data might be applied to secondary uses that have nothing to do with the reason that information was originally collected.
Well, two quick examples. One is Google uses search queries that it receives from people. It receives about a billion a day from searchers in the United States, and it uses these search terms to predict the spread of the seasonal flu in the United States. Now, people send search terms to Google in order to get search results and be guided on the internet where to look. Reusing these search terms to predict the spread of the flu is a secondary purpose and is wonderfully valuable to public health officials. Or take Faircast that uses airline reservation data to predict whether or not a particular flight ticket is going to go up or down in price. That's also reusing data that has been collected for a different purpose and extract some additional value out of it.
And the example of Google predicting the flu, they actually were faster at this than the CDC using more traditional methods.
Oh, yes. The Centers for Disease Control took about a week to two to tabulate all the information up. And it usually also took people a couple of days to go to their doctors, and then the doctors would relate that information to the CDC. So the CDC had a view back into the past, which isn't much helpful if you fight a pandemic. But Google could do the same analysis practically in real time.
And how are different data sets offered and sold to those who might be interested in analyzing information that they have not collected themselves?
Well, first of all, there are now data markets out there, so people can buy access to data sets. And then there are intermediaries who collect a lot of data and offer to do the analysis themselves or offer to help companies in the analysis. Data really is a new resource, and it is like water or gold or electricity, and therefore it will be mined and will be very much in demand in the coming years.
And it's interesting that you say electricity, because when we first discovered that this existed, we didn't necessarily know how it worked, and we didn't know quite what to do with it, that what practical application it would have.
Yes, that's right. And so, for example, a lot of very large internet companies, perhaps with Facebook being the poster child, are now collecting an enormous amount of information every day. You have to just imagine that there's 10 million photos uploaded to Facebook every single hour, every single day. So they're collecting all of that information. They're collecting all the likes and the dislikes. They're not throwing anything away in the hope that eventually they can use all this data and extract some meaning out of it and extract some value out of it that goes beyond giving users adverts on the right-hand side of the screen.
So talk about this. How does big data value knowing what appears to be true without knowing necessarily why it is true?
Well, let me give you an example here, an example that comes from medical research up in Canada. They studied premature babies, and premature babies are really prone to suffer from very severe infections. The problem is that when the premature baby has an infection, and you know it, oftentimes it's too late to battle it with drugs. So it's really important to get to know the infection very early on. And normally, premature babies would have their vitals measured every couple of hours or so. But in Canada, researchers used new sensors, and they measured the vital signs of the baby continuously, so that it resulted in 1,000 data points a second.
Hmm.
And they did that over a long period of time, and then they had other premature babies as well, and then they went and did some data analysis and found out that they could predict the onset of an infection of a premature baby 24 hours in advance.
Wow.
24 hours before any doctor would say, oops, something is wrong here because the baby has a fever. But interestingly enough, the telltale sign of an infection, of an impending infection, wasn't that the vital signs were going haywire. It was that the vital signs would stabilize.
Hmm.
What doctor would have thought about that? Now, that gives these researchers a tool by which they can spot the infection early on and then help doctors give the premature child the drugs to combat the infection very early on. The result is that babies' lives are being saved, even though the researchers don't know why these vital signs stabilize. They have no idea, but what, knowing what, trumps knowing why.
Of course, sometimes it's fine to not know why yet and be able to put this information into practice, but I was thinking as I read the book about a study I heard about years ago that found that parents who use nightlights in their babies' rooms were more likely to have babies who grew up to need eyeglasses.
Mm-hmm.
That seemed to be the cause of things, and then a few years later, it occurred to them to ask how many of the parents wore eyeglasses, and it turned out that myopic parents had myopic babies, and
yes,
that was the cause.
Yes, indeed. What you're pointing us to is the human weakness to see the world through a lens of causes and effects. We look at the world and want to understand the world, and we want to understand the why. It's sort of hardwired into our brains. So, for example, when you go to a restaurant and we fall sick the next day, we think it might have been the food in the restaurant, even though it is far more likely that we got the stomach bug by shaking hands with a colleague.
Mm-hmm.
But our brain kind of comes up with these causal hunches. This must have been the reason. And these causal hunches are comforting. They give us sort of a sense of understanding in this very complex world in which we live. but very oftentimes they're just plain wrong. And so our elusive quest for causality, we can, with big data, put aside at least some of the time and just investigate the what, and oftentimes it turns out that the what is just good enough, as the example with the premature baby shows. Or another example is car engines. We now can understand through big data analysis the telltale signs of engine parts breaking down days before they actually break. And so we can do what is called predictive maintenance, bring them to the car shop when it's convenient for us rather than have the car break down on the side of the and on the road and we have to stop it on the side and have to tow it to the repair shop.
What does all this information do to our sense that we can trust our own observations?
You know, in a way, we are waking up into a world that the researchers woke up like 500 years when they invented the microscope. With the microscope, they could look into a world that was completely hidden before. With big data, we can also look into a world that until very recently was very hidden from us. It is the world of data that tells us, not why, but that tells us how things and what things are doing out there and how they are connected. And that is quite valuable.
So how are corporations using big data as a way of figuring out exactly what it is their customers want and need and are willing to pay for?
Well, we all are familiar with early big data applications like Amazon's book recommendations or Netflix video and movie recommendations. What is really interesting is that Amazon originally didn't have the big data recommendations, the book recommendations that we all are so familiar with. Instead, they had dozens and dozens of professional reviewers on staff who would read the books and then write professional reviews, like the New York Review of Books or the New York Times book review or any of those. And they would be published on the website, and Amazon thought that this might entice readers to buy these books. But then they developed the recommendation system that gave individualized recommendations using big data analysis based on previous shopping data to each of their customers. And they ran a comparison test. And the result was that it wasn't even close. And the reviewers were let go because the recommendation system was so good that today it is said to account for 30% of Amazon's revenue.
Aren't those also, though, those algorithms that are used to predict what books you will like based on what others like you have liked, those are self-reinforcing, aren't they?
They may be self-reinforcing also. Some of the people who like the book that you are liking as well then develop a new taste, that might spill over into your recommendations as well. But again, this is sort of probabilistic. It's based on probabilities. It cannot perfectly foresee the future and predict what we are going to shop. But if it is right just 4 out of 5 times, that brings a lot of money to Amazon.
Victor Meyer Schoenberger is my guest. He is professor of Internet Governance and Regulation at the Oxford Internet Institute at Oxford University and co-author, along with Kenneth Cukier, of the new book Big Data, a revolution that will transform how we live, work, and think. We have phone lines open now if you'd like to join us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also get to us via email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can give your kids or grandkids a creative and educational experience this summer at SMU in Plano. smu.edu/CAPE Summer Youth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Victor Meyer-Schoenberger. He is professor of Internet Governance and Regulation at the Oxford Internet Institute at Oxford University and co-author of the new book, Big Data, a revolution that will transform how we live, work, and think. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Victor, when we do business online or with any organization that collects and analyzes big data, do we have any control whatsoever over how that information is used?
Well, yes and no. Most of the good practices, the good privacy practices, will suggest to these companies that they tell us through a notice that they give us on screen why they are going to collect the data and what data they are collecting. And then we have to click consent. That is accept, and thereby accept the notice and the terms of service, and then they can do whatever they want to do. The problem is that most of the time, even today, when we get these notices, we just click consent and accept and don't really think about it because we want the online service.
Right. If we say no, we're out of luck. We are out of luck,
mm-hmm. and then we can't use this particular internet service, and so we just automatically just click OK. So that moment, we basically have given up our rights to that particular piece of personal information, and then they will just use it.
And a lot of consumers who might be concerned about this are sort of told, well, don't worry, because none of this can be traced back to you. And that turns out to be a more complicated issue than it might seem.
It is. A lot of times, these internet companies say what we are going to do is going to anonymize the data that we have. We take your name out. We take your social security number if we have it out. We take your credit card number out if we give it to third parties, if we give it to marketing companies. It is just your preferences, but your personally identifiable information has been taken out. And it turns out that in the big data age, when we have data sources that have been supposedly anonymized or de-identified, then by combining these data sources together, we can often re-identify it. AOL suffered something like that a couple of years ago when they just made public search queries that they had received from their users, and they had taken all of the names and other identifiers out. But within 2 days, two reporters were able to re-identify a 61-year-old widow from rural Georgia and call her up and say, did you know that we have all of your search terms? Hmm. Because AOL made them public, and they supposedly anonymized them, but by just combining the data sets and looking at them more closely, we could re-identify you. And she was completely shocked, and so were many others, and AOL had to apologize and so forth. But only a few weeks later, Netflix did the same or made the same mistake. The big data age really does away with some of the effectiveness of anonymization or de-identification that we have been promised would work.
Are we more suspicious of the hands of government in our data than we are the hands of corporate entities?
We should be. We should be concerned about both, in a way. The federal government, in particular, is collecting through its three-letter agencies an enormous amount of information from the Internet and from other sources and keeping them in very large digital storages. And they do big data analysis. Much of it is, of course, top secret, and we are not privy to it, which should make us even more concerned at times. But then the private sector is hoarding a lot of information as well. You have to imagine that Google processes more information in a single day than what is stored in the entire Library of Congress 100 times over.
And I don't have the ability to call up Google and say, I would like the file on my profile based on my search terms and where you know I live and where I've traveled and that sort of thing.
No, you don't have that right. There is a bit of a hacker group within Google called the Data Liberation Front, and they create tools by which you can sort of extract personal information out of some of the Google services to help you take your personal data away from Google and to a different service provider. But this is a small group. Similarly, Facebook now has the ability to sort of let you download all of the personal information that they have about you. I did it, and I was just amazed by how much they had. I had forgotten most of it. And it doesn't just contain what I put into Facebook, but what other people wrote about me as well.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. You can also email us at think@kera.org as we speak with Victor Meyer Schoenberger about his book, Big Data. We have an email here from Peter who writes, as an IT knowledge worker and Amazon user, I'm following the program with great interest. However, I have to say that if Amazon's recommendation system is a measure of big data, then personally, it's a pretty sorry measure. I'm constantly amazed and annoyed at the ridiculous recommendations Amazon sends to me. The only real worry I witness with big data is how corporations have come to totally believe what the results are without critical thought. What do you think about that?
Well, I'd say that, Peter, that I'm sorry that book recommendations from Amazon don't work for you. I might be in a different category here. I have to confess that a lot of times I have clicked on the buy button on Amazon book recommendations that I received. And we need to be quite careful about that as well, because there is a perception problem here. We oftentimes just remember the ridiculous recommendations that we get, much like we remember the red light when we drive home from work,
right,
and say, oh my God, I had like 10 red lights. But we don't really recall the green lights that we had. Similarly, we don't often recall the good recommendations that showed us books either that we already bought or that we have clicked on to buy.
So talk about a little bit more about the government, because, you know, we sort of assume that they're out to get the bad guys, and they are doing this thing called predictive policing in a lot of even municipalities at this point. What is that?
Well, predictive policing is trying to use big data in order to predict in which neighborhood, at what time of the day and at what day of the week, there is a strong likelihood for crimes to be committed, so that law enforcement agencies can assign scarce resources like police cars, officers on the beat, to these neighborhoods and thereby assure that less crime is happening there at that time. So that is a way by which, through big data, we can make sure that the limited resources that law enforcement has available are used most effectively.
A couple steps beyond that is the idea that law enforcement might imagine that based on big data calculations, they might know which individuals might commit crimes.
Indeed. So when we look at predictive policing and say, well, on one hand side, this is a really good idea. It tries to make the most out of the limited budgets that we have in law enforcement. At the same time, if you push it too far, it has quite some problems attached to it. If it is too general and not too individual, then it might make an entire neighborhood suspect.
Mm-hmm.
And if you keep on looking for crime in one neighborhood but not in the others, you will find crime in that neighborhood but not in the others. And so that's sort of a self-reinforcing prediction, if you want. And then you police these neighborhoods even more and even more. There's a somewhat different but even more troubling problem if we predict down to the individual.
Yeah.
Because if we are predicting down to the individual and are then going out and holding people responsible, penalizing them, punishing them, not for what they have done for behavior in the past, but for what they are predicted through our big data analysis they're going to do, then we are right in the middle of Minority Report,
yeah,
of the movie that you might remember, in which people were penalized and sent to prison not for what they have done, but for what they were predicted to do.
And then the question is, you know, how do we stop short of that and yet use this technology to protect ourselves? So is it an infringement to, based on a profile, sort of surveil someone, but not technically speaking, arrest that person or put them in custody?
You know, it's really a fundamental question of the use, of how we are using the big data results that we're getting. Keep in mind that, as I said earlier, big data cannot tell us why. It can only tell us what is happening. So we cannot use big data analysis and big data results to go out and to hold people responsible and to say, you committed this crime, you are responsible for this crime, because that is suggesting causality. And we can't get causality causes out of big data analysis. So that would be a misuse of big data and big data analysis. The problem is that, of course, we human beings want causality. We long for to uncover causes. And so big data is under constant threat to be abused, not only by law enforcement, but by private sector companies as well, to make causal decisions based on big data correlations.
And it's funny how comfortable, how much more comfortable we are with that when the focus is someone else, as opposed to when we might fall into those categories of, say, having all the risk factors for particular criminal behavior but not doing it. It becomes much more scary when we imagine it might be applied incorrectly to us.
Right. And when we are when we want life-saving surgery and we are told, sorry, you can't have that surgery because you are predicted to start smoking in 2 years, and that will just reduce your survival rates, and we don't want to spend that money on you, then we are completely shocked. But at the same time, we look at the soaring healthcare costs and say, oh, well, we need to do something to sort of rein in these costs. We need to be careful that we don't create a society that is overly efficient because we take humanity out of it.
And it's not just marketing and it's not just law enforcement. It's things like how likely you are to succeed at a particular university beyond the things that might show up in your grades and your transcripts, or how likely you are to succeed at a job.
Oh, yes, absolutely. In a way, with big data analysis, companies that are hiring people might make predictions about how well they're going to do. Then people might be denied a job. And the problem is that they don't know why they were denied a job. All that they might get in the future as an answer is, oh, we did a big data analysis and we factored in 400 different data points or signals about your past, and that gave us a very good prediction into the future. But then the people that are affected by it say, but how can I change if I'm just being told that a decision was made based on data that I'm not allowed to review, and a decision was made based on computer algorithms that I don't understand? That is just something that we as a society have to address.
And of course, Victor, the converse is true as well. Someone might be predicted to do very well, might be elevated to a particular position, and because the big data says they belong there, it might take us a while to recognize that something is not working.
Oh, yes, we've seen that in many, many times over with con artists in the financial services industry and so forth setting up Ponzi schemes just because they were so persuasive in how they appeared, and they had faked a lot of the small data points that we usually use to make our assessment and our judgment of other people.
Victor Meyer-Schoenberger is here. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go on the phone now to Martin in Fort Worth. Hi, Martin.
Yeah, hello, Chris.
Hi.
I like to know. It's very intriguing. You know, with all the talk these days and concern we have as people about, you know, corporations and the illicit profits that they're making, you know, it concerns me with the stock market and the private sector and big business in general. With this information going forward, it would seem that they would be able to predict how we would behave to you know, do a bait and switch, or be able to take more of our money away from us without us knowing, or by tricking us in some way.
What do you think about that, Victor?
Well, yes, in a way, there will be companies in the future who abuse and misuse big data. And sometimes we need to expose them, and that will be good enough so that nobody is, or very few people are going to do business with them. And somebody, sometimes even government regulators might step in and have to stop this from happening. Take insurance as an example. If we, with big data analysis, are able to predict a person's life expectancy extremely well, or predict worse, a person's driving skills very well, then suddenly insurance companies might, if there is no government regulation against that, might charge us differently, different premiums based on our driving skills. Not the driving skills of the past, but the driving skills of the future. And that might just destroy the entire market of car insurance, and then, in fact, the government would need to step in and just say, look, insurance industry, you cannot discriminate based on future predictions of driving behavior. These are the kind of measures that we need if we want to preserve our society going forward into the big data era.
I mean, was the insurance industry really a pioneer in all of this? Because they've been trying to figure these things out with actuarial tables for decades.
Yes, but they were. But to our knowledge, the insurance industry has been focused more on small data and sampling, sort of the traditional statistical methods. Credit card companies are quite good at big data analysis because they really use big data to identify fraud, credit card fraud. And credit card fraud is very hard to find using traditional statistical sampling methods, the small data kind of tools that we had before big data. But fraud can be easily or much easier detected using big data tools. And so the credit card industry was really a very early big data poster child.
Victor Meyer Schoenberger is my guest. He's professor of Internet Governance and Regulation at the Oxford Internet Institute at Oxford University and co-author, along with Kenneth Couquier, of the new book Big Data, a revolution that will transform how we live, work, and think. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can give your kids or grandkids a creative and educational experience this summer at SMU in Plano. smu.edu/CAPE Summer Youth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Victor Meyer Schoenberger, professor of Internet Governance and Regulation at the Oxford Internet Institute at Oxford University. He is also co-author of the new book Big Data, a revolution that will transform how we live, work, and think. Join the conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. So talk about this, Victor. The idea you already mentioned, it's difficult for us to have access to the data that may have been aggregated and applied to us as individuals. What can we know about the algorithms used to draw big data conclusions?
Well, right now we don't know anything. So both the data that is being used and the algorithm that is employed are residing in a black box. And in the book, we talk a lot about what we can do to open up the black box and make sure that individuals are not disenfranchised, are not negatively impacted without having the possibility to have their side of the story heard. And one suggestion that we make is that we might need special cast of professionals that we call algorithmists that are trained in big data analysis to help individuals to peek into that black box, but also to help companies that want their algorithms to be certified, audited and certified. Think of it like a professional like civil engineers or doctors. They would be sworn to confidentiality and professionalism and impartiality, but those algorithmists would come in and sort of take a look at the algorithm, take a look at the data, and then go out and be able to tell the individuals that either that was okay or that there was a flaw in there, and then that flaw would need to be exposed and corrected.
So is there any kind of professional organization of people who do this now, and do they have ethical standards?
You know, right now in the sort of small data age, if you want, we have privacy professionals that ensure that privacy rules are being adhered to in large corporations and in large government organizations. And they have their own professional ethics and rules and meetings and certification processes in place. We envision for algorithmists something quite similar to that, or quite similar to professional auditors or civil engineers in the engineering side.
And when you talk about opening things up so that there is not so much of a black box around this from the perspective of individuals, it's not so different than, since you mentioned the credit industry was one of the first to really pioneer big data, it's not so different from the ability people have to at least annotate their credit reports to reflect that they disagree with something that's on there.
Yes, indeed. And the credit report is a wonderful example. One of the troubles that big data analysis has is that if you are told that 800 different data points or signals went into the analysis using a very complex algorithm, but you are told that the company will not tell you either the algorithm or what kind of data went in, then how can you change your behavior? So if you're denied a mortgage, for example, based on big data analysis, how can you change your behavior so that your credit worthiness improves? And you will get a mortgage the next time around they do the big data analysis. It's really important to make sure that people understand what affects their scores, what affects the outcome of big data analysis, because only then will they be able to change their behavior. And with behavioral change, we actually receive better results. For example, if people are told that if you pay back your credit card on time, your credit card use on time, then in fact your credit score with big data analysis will go up, then I know what I have to do in order to improve my credit score, and then society is better off as well because I pay my credit card bill on time.
Of course, some of these data points may be things that become almost ridiculous. A few years ago on the show, we talked about a study that found that people who purchase like those felt pads for the bottom of a chair to protect your hardwood floors are more likely to pay their credit cards on time. And if that kind of data is going into these analyses, I mean, at some point, I mean, how much can you do?
Yeah, there's a lot of a little bit of black magic, if you want, involved in this. So FICO, the credit reporting or credit score company, is in fact thinking that it can predict whether or not we take our medication on time just by looking at our financial data.
Hmm.
And that might be right, that probability might be there, the analysis might be correct. But then what does it mean if we are told exactly what influences our credit score, our financial health score, is not going to be revealed? Then we cannot even affect our health medication prediction score because we're just not told what goes into this black box. This is really weird, and we need some transparency and some oversight here.
And this, of course, is before we have added everyone's personal genetic profile to the bank of big data, and we're probably only a few years down the road from insurance companies at least wishing they could have access to this, even if we are pushing back.
Yes, and think about genetic data. Genetic data is like networking data. If you reveal your genetic data, you're not only revealing your personal genetic data, you're revealing genetic data of your family.
Right.
And so even if you would be fine with that, you'd suddenly have revealed the genetic information of your siblings, or of your children, of your parents, by revealing your own personal genetic information. It's very similar to Facebook. In fact, students of mine have looked at Twitter and Facebook data, and they were able to find out that just by looking at who are your friends and where they are, they can predict your location better than they can predict your location using your cell phone data.
So would we be better off with some kind of disclosure laws for algorithms in particular? And what are the most important issues to consider if we were to create such legislation, given that these algorithms are valuable and the people who created them have worked hard on them and there are many different interests to be balanced?
Yes, indeed. The algorithms, of course, are, if you want, the crown jewels of some of the companies around. And so it's understandable they don't want to reveal that. It's like the formula of Coca-Cola. And that is why the sort of professional cast of algorithmists is something that we think could help. The algorithmists would go in. They would be given a peek into the algorithm, but they would have been sworn to confidentiality and therefore could not reveal what they have seen, only use what they have seen to test the algorithm and the validity of it. So we have an intermediary that we can trust, and that intermediary then gets all the information, gets all the transparency that it is needed. If we have full transparency without an intermediary, if companies are forced to disclose their algorithms, then competitors would just steal that bit of insight and innovation that is vested, that is in the algorithm. That would not be a good way forward. Hence, the algorithmists as sort of a buffer, a transparency buffer in between.
Are the people creating these algorithms now and working with them and presenting them to whatever entity has requested them, are they mostly computer scientists and mathematicians?
They are computer scientists. They are statisticians. Going forward in the future, we see the algorithmists to be really trained multidisciplinarily, so with sort of an understanding of computer scripts, an understanding of statistics and math, but also an understanding of the underlying ethics and the sort of deep social and ethical questions that are involved in making predictions about other human beings, so that they would come to this particular task that is also a very challenging and a very important task, well prepared.
What about as social scientists and physicians and other people in academia even start to look at this data, are we more likely to see these algorithmists sort of arising from these other fields and making their way over into actually creating these formulas?
Well, these big data analysts, whether they are working as algorithmists in sort of certifying algorithms and big data analysis, or where the data analysts work as part of a big data department in a large company. And these are really people who need to be well-educated and well-trained. Oftentimes, though, they don't need to be subject matter experts anymore. I'll give you an example. I told earlier on in this program about the premature babies and how they have found out that they can predict the infections 24 hours before the onset. Now, the doctor, Dr. Carolyn McGregor, who ran the research and who headed the research team, Dr. McGregor is not a medical doctor. She's a computer scientist. And she was able to see this. So this is really interesting. Suddenly, you don't need to be a medical doctor anymore in the big data age to make a to find a medical discovery, to make a medical breakthrough. You don't need to be a physicist, or you don't need to be a marketing guru in order to find out a very novel insight using big data. You could be a statistician.
So how can we tell the difference? There are clearly some cases where it might not be that important to seek causation once correlation has been clearly established. How do we know where to invest our time in looking for causation?
Well, here big data can help us as well. As we show in the book, big data can become a filtering device in a way, telling us what kind of connections to look further into and to investigate. So if Dr. McGregor looked even more closely at what kind of vital signs predict the onset of an infection, that might give doctors then a better sense in what kind of possible causal connections to investigate and to look closer in. So in that sense, it's correlations and correlation analysis, big data analysis, is a huge time saver because you right now you don't know what kind of causal connection to look into, mm-hmm. but with correlational analysis, you can eliminate the 50 million that are just useless and come up with five or six to further investigate. And that's incredibly helpful as a time saver for researchers.
Will we ever be able to sort of plan for and predict black swan events, these things that nobody could have expected? Will we ever create formulas sophisticated enough to plan for these?
I don't know, but with big data analysis, what I do know is that big data analysis is probabilistic. It gives us a probability, and it's based on predictions of the past or of the present, looking into the future. These predictions are usually not able to account for the unknown, mm-hmm. for the black swan events. So big data analysis is not good for black swan events. For that, we need something else. But big data analysis is quite good in uncovering connections that we never thought of before. For example, another research came out of Microsoft the other day where they found out that they could use internet search data to uncover adverse drug effects months before they were actually found by the drug producers, just by what people looked for.
Victor, do you see a bright future for this where we continue to refine our ability to do this ethically, or are you concerned that this could get way out of control?
Chris, I view big data as an incredibly powerful tool, much like, as I said earlier on, electricity or take antibiotics. Mm-hmm. Because it's so powerful, there is also the danger of abuse. So we need to take this powerful the improvement of society, but at the same time be very, very careful to put the safeguards in place so that the tool cannot or can only very rarely be abused. And that is the kind of path that we need to go and assure we have going forward, that we are embracing it, but embracing it not blindly, embracing big data analysis not blindly, but embracing it with a critical eye and an understanding that safeguards need to be put in place.
We just have a few seconds left. In a word or two, do you think lawmakers understand this as well as they need to at this point?
No, but I hope they read the book.
Victor Meyer Schoenberger is professor of Internet Governance and Regulation at the Oxford Internet Institute at Oxford University. His new book, written with Kenneth Couquier, is called Big Data, a revolution that will transform how we live, work, and think. Victor, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Chris, for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer with help today from Lindsay Connect. You can learn more about the show and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. And we always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. You can email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.